Because it's just us, and you know, this is a conversation rather than a class, I can hold forth as I normally do, but we can also just sort of make the topic through questions and answers and conversation if you would like. Shall we start like that? And I mean, I'll give you full and complete answers, but maybe if the topic itself interests you. Sometimes people come just because I'm talking and they're not interested in the topic, so this doesn't work. But maybe tonight, I know that you asked a lot of questions that we could just begin with. So how does that seem to you? So where shall we start? Which end of the room shall we start at? David, do you have any specific thoughts about being here tonight?
I didn't have any specific questions or anything. Mm-hmm. I just had good experiences with your talks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very glad for that reason. Usually we have more of you tonight. Okay, what about you, Christine?
I'm one of those who were talking, so I'm
here. Okay. Well, I know Alan has a lot of questions. What about you, Esther? Did you have a specific interest in tonight? Or
No, but if I hear you talking, so I would have questions.
Okay. Well, I don't know if Fred has anything specific on his mind. Okay. Alan, would you like to ask your questions, or would you like me to start first? What would you prefer? I'm going to pause for a second and admire your green sweater. It's very pleasant to look at. I like it when people wear colors that I can look at. Okay, you.
My question was essentially about group karma versus individual karma,
right?
And the economic recession being an example of group karma,
right?
Like an overall karma. That you know, even though individuals may try to, increase their spirituality and renounce materialistic desires. Still, the overall karma has sway, and if the larger picture is going in the opposite direction,
right?
I think my concern is just how do people of goodwill or people who are well situated help contribute to lessening that bad karma in the group?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Well, I think what I'll need to do, since you're not really helping me very much, except for Alan, I'll set an overall picture, and then we can go from there. Nobody likes to hear bad news, and there is a certain semi-true concept that if you don't give voice to negative realities, that somehow those negative realities will disappear. And it's kind of a half-truth. So most recently, Swami Kriyananda, who's the leader of our Ananda community, has been speaking a lot about the predictions that were made by his guru, Yogananda. Yogananda died in 1952, but in the last years of Yogananda's life, which was now like, 60 years ago, he often told people that there was going to be very, very difficult times coming to America and to the whole world. And as Swami Kriyananda said, he made it seem like it was going to happen, the next spring. He didn't make it seem like decades would go by before what he actually called a terrible cataclysm would strike this country. So throughout the point of view of all those disciples who lived with Yogananda, there was always this prophecy going on. And it wasn't a prophecy that Yogananda made as a curse, and it wasn't a prophecy that he made casually. It wasn't that he just said, sort of maybe. He spoke about the necessity for people to change their lifestyle. He spoke of the importance of living together in intentional communities, with spiritually based intentional communities, about living in the country, being able to grow your own food, just sort of having a certain amount of independence. And Swami Kriyananda, who devoted his life to fulfilling the work of his guru, has founded cooperative intentional communities, a big rural community up near Grass Valley. We have an apartment complex, which we've turned into a community here in the Mountain View area, There's several others around the country, and in, one in Europe and one in India. But part of the motivation, but by no means the only motivation or even the main motivation, was the idea that it's an alternative lifestyle and it's a more secure lifestyle than the direction that society's been going. But now 60 years have passed and, you know, there have been really boom times. And I've been with Ananda for 40 years, which is kind of startling to me when I say numbers like that, because they don't feel like, from this end, they don't feel as big as they felt from the other end. When I would hear 40 years when I was 20, it seemed like a long time. When I speak of 40 years from 60 and look back, it doesn't seem long. But so it's always been in the back of my mind that there would be some radical change in the way society was structured. My family is Jewish, and so I was born in 1947, so the idea of your whole life being totally disrupted by some political or social event is deeply ingrained in me anyway. And it's actually been a sort of a joke, as I realize it, that in my whole life I've always thought there's no point in accumulating anything, because in the end it'll all be taken from you anyway. And I'd say that sort of laughingly, but to me it's always been even slightly lighthearted, which is, you know, I guess when you're Jewish, you just expect there to be something wipes you out sooner or later. One of my friends has all these heirlooms that have been in her family for 3 or 4 or 5 generations. And it finally occurred to me, really just the other day, her heirlooms always seemed odd to me. And I realized that in Jewish families, you don't have heirlooms. Because you had to run from Eastern Europe, and then you had to run from Western Europe, and so you don't get to keep things for generations. It's just all different points of view. You know, we all sort of have these are cultural biases that are part of the group karma that we move into, and we have them for particular reasons. Well, I'm putting all that by way of background, because many people have been quite upset with Swami Kriyananda for talking about, because for about 6 or 8 months, from September into the spring, every time he talked, he would talk about this. It was not a pleasant topic. We would rather he would talk about something else, but this is what he would always talk about. And he didn't do it because it was fun. He did it because he felt a profound and serious obligation to pass on what Yogananda had told him. As a good disciple, that's what you have to do. And many people would say to him, you know, by talking about it, you're bringing it about. And Swami tried to make a very, very important distinction that the fact of the matter is, it's not merely the articulation of words that creates an attracting force. It's the vibration and the magnetism that you have behind those words. Because what really moves energy is the fields of magnetism. And the quality and the quantity of the energy that we put out, and therefore the magnetism that we generate, is the determining factor in our fate. Now, Einstein told us at the beginning of this century that matter is an illusion, that it's really just an energy field. And in the last 100 years, the concept of energy, which people never really talked about much before, is talked about all the time. I mean, sometimes we're talking about depletable energies. We're talking about oil fields, or we're talking about auric energies or karmic energies or whatever it is. But we think in those terms, because in the last 100 years, there's been a whole like revolution of consciousness into a more subtle reality. Now, this is also part of Yogananda's explanations of what's happening and why, because he didn't just state, oh, horrible times are coming, put your head in the sand, it's over. He said what's actually happening is that the whole planet is undergoing an enormous transformation, and that some transformations don't happen smoothly, that the old forces hit the new forces, and then there's some kind of a striking of those realities, and something breaks in the process. So what he really talked about was that there's a whole new social reality that's coming into being now. Now, he talked about this in 1952, and since then we've seen an enormous amount of it happening. And he talked about it as not merely just a little bit of a political change or a social change, but an entirely new consciousness coming into this planet, which is part of a huge time cycle of shifting ages on this earth, which has been a very old tradition in many societies, including the Indian society from which this comes, and that we are right in the middle of one of those transitions, that the age of solid matter actually came to an end in the year 1700. And I don't mean that things are no longer solid, but the hypnosis that sort of held man in thrall, that matter was the only reality, began to shift around 1700, and it shifted more dramatically around 1900. And now we're definitely into what's literally called the age of energy, from the age of matter to the age of energy. There's Sanskrit names for these, Kali Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, but it's the age of matter to the age of energy. Now, the reason for that is actually astronomical, not even astrological, having to do with our sun being, and this is how it's explained in the Indian tradition, being in an elliptical orbit that moves it closer and farther away from the center of our galaxy. And this theory, which is explained in a book called Dark Star, and in another book which is about to be published, which is called The Yugas, Y-U-G-A-S, that's the name of it. When it comes out, you'll be able to find it here. And the theory is that our sun has a dual, and the two of them go in this elliptical orbit, and that orbit moves our whole solar system closer and then farther away again from the center of our galaxy, from which emanates the activating energy of this whole solar system. When we're closer to that center, this planet has higher consciousness. When we're farther away from the center, this planet has darker consciousness. Darker means less aware, less capable of perceiving subtle realities. Now, that whole cycle is 24,000 years, so it's not like one person just kind of hangs out and watches the whole thing. It's 12 years moving toward, 12,000 years moving away. Plato speaks of something very similar. All of the legends of Atlantis and the ancient civilizations of Egypt and that you hear about these very advanced civilizations all make sense if you think of the timing of those being high ages and then coming down to a lower and lower age in which that subtlety was lost. That was 499 is when we hit the nadir, AD. And then we start back up the other side, and then all of a sudden, starting from 1900, I mean, look at what's happened in terms of a total revolution of the way we live on this planet, and it's all been based on energy when you think about it. It's all been based on the discovery. During Kali Yuga, there was only one kind of energy, physical energy. It was the physical energy of human beings or the physical energy of animals. I mean, there was no steam, there was no electricity, what to speak of all the much more subtle energies that we use now. You just push things around. And even when they started making engines, they measured them by horsepower. We still talk about horsepower without even thinking. Who knows how much a horse can move? But at that point, that was the only way to think about it. Yes, Alan, what were you going to ask?
Well, I've always heard that the yugas were much longer than that, but this really accords much more closely to the way history actually has
shown it.
Yeah.
Now, there's a tradition that in India, when just to just to give us a visual here since we're doing this, if you think of this as the apex and this is the nadir of this circle, at this point, people are going to have more subtle understanding, remembering it from a higher age, that the lower you get, the less you'll be able to remember. It was right around here that all the libraries were burned and that the barbarians swept over the planet. Hi. And right around in here, an understanding of this cycle was also lost. And the tradition began to be that each of these ages was like 400,000 years each. And then, so the thought would be that we were in Kali Yuga, which is the darkest age, and we would be in it for hundreds of thousands of years more. But that was part of the ignorance of this age. which was literally corrected by Yogananda's guru in Autobiography of a Yogi. And in India, still, they'll tell you that it's Kali Yuga and it's going to be Kali Yuga for 400,000 years. But in fact, according to other sources, it's not. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I just bought the book, Sri Yukteswar's book, and I was just reading the introduction.
Yeah,
and was talking
exactly. The word is yugas, which means ages. And there's
so where are we now?
We are right here, going this way. this was Kali Yuga. Each of these, see, Kali Yuga happens twice. Kali Yuga is the age of matter. And Kali Yuga coming down, and then Kali Yuga coming back up. You know, Kali Yuga going down is really, really gruesome. And this point here is 499 AD. So that means that Jesus was born, you know, around in here, and he was born in the darkest age going down. Now, think about the life of Jesus. He's a great master. He comes to bring this great message, and what happens to him? He's crucified. And it's like, that's how in Kali Yuga people perceive these things. And, you know, he was physically killed, and being crucified was what they did to everybody at that time. It wasn't even like special for him. Crucified on the public road was the consciousness of how dark the consciousness on the planet of Kali Yuga was. I mean, just imagine, we're all going out to dinner, you know, we go on to El Camino, and there's all these people lined up being crucified, you know, just sort of on the public streets. I mean, it's literally unimaginable, because we're now Dwapara Yuga rising, which is 1900 here. It's actually shifts about seven. It's shifted about 1700. You know, you just can't, it just wouldn't happen anymore, because the planet's too enlightened. And even though we're still executing people, there's a huge outcry against it. Whereas Kali Yuga descending, nobody even thought it was odd. You know, somebody does something wrong, you kill them. That's how you deal with it.
But there is part of the planet that is not enlightened at all.
Say again?
There is part of the planet, of people on the planet that are not enlightened at all.
Well, you know, now part of the things you...
even
now. But see, what happens is, even now... Okay, this let me hold on for just a second, then I'll come back to there. But see, here's what's interesting. Jesus was fully enlightened. And many of his disciples were fully enlightened. Because this is a planetary, just to finish it, this is the end of Dwapara Yuga. Then comes Treta, which is the age of the mind, mental energy. And then this is Satya Yuga, and this is the age of the spirit. And then we apex with Satya Yuga, and then you have Satya Yuga coming down. And like right around in here, somewhere, I'm not drawing this very accurately, but, and this would be Treta Yuga going down. The pyramids of Egypt, for example, were built around here. I mean, when you get the book called The Yugas, you can look all this up, which is marvelous. But what will happen is, you see, as we get higher and higher, and when we start matching across, then we'll start understanding what was going on at that time. Until then, we're just guessing, because we don't have the subtlety to understand it. Interesting. So we think that a whole bunch of Jewish slaves drag those rocks around. But it doesn't make any sense, because, you know, no human beings could have lifted those stones and built those pyramids the way they built them. The proposed theory by those who have greater understanding is that they were moved by the power of sound, which is not as preposterous as you think it is, because now we dissolve kidney stones with the power of sound. We take pictures of the unborn baby with the power of sound, which would have just been, in Kali Yuga, would have just been considered insane. We had to cut somebody open to get the kidney stones out. Now you just penetrate with sound waves.
Sorry,
yeah. No, go ahead.
Can you move the board a little bit?
Because... Very good. Thank you, dear.
So what part was that where the Egyptian could move stone?
Well, I'm not being exact. See, we are here. This is 1900, so we're about right here. Okay, the pyramids are about here in this cycle, and we're here. So you see, we have a ways to go. And the thing about all that we know about history was either Kali Yuga, which is the very materialistic age, or we have fragments of higher ages, but we no longer understand how those things were accomplished. And as we become more enlightened, we begin to realize that artifacts, for example, there's that whole incredible navigational device that people found that we call everything a primitive object of worship. But when we look at it more closely, we see it's a dry cell battery or a astronomical device or, you know, just things that we didn't think these people knew anything about. But as we come up on this side, we're beginning to be able to recognize. Okay? I can do more with this. Is this enough for us to understand the general idea? So in terms of Yogananda's predictions about the difficulties that we're going through, what we're shifting from is where there's this planetary consciousness. Now, bear in mind, and it's very important to understand, this is a planet, the reality of the overall vibration of a planet. This is not the overall vibration of the universe, and this is not about individual karma, but this is the adventure of Earth. This is the history of Earth. And Earth is going from an age in which a fixed matter into an age of energy, which is Dwapara, which just simply means second, but it means the age of energy. It is the age of energy. And as I was saying earlier, a moment ago, if anything characterizes where we are right now, it's all these different and more dynamic forms of energy. And one of the characteristics of Dwapara Yuga time is that the barrier of space is dissolved, meaning that I'm old enough to remember airmail letters, you know. And when you would have a transatlantic call, you would shout into the phone and it would cost you a fortune and you'd talk for a minute or two. And you could barely understand. Now, I write the email, they pick it up. I'm on instant messaging, we're talking in the moment. We're talking on Skype and looking at each other's pictures. It's like I have friends all over the world and we can keep in touch as much as we want to. I can take my computer wherever I go and just talk to people. They have no idea where I am. They don't know whether I'm sitting in my house in Mountain View or on the beach in Costa Rica or in the ashram in New Delhi. I could be anywhere. Hi, how are you doing? Oh, just fine. You know, a minute later I'm talking to them. Because in Dwapara Yuga, space is dissolved. In Treta Yuga, time is dissolved. And just in the same way that we've been able to overcome the limitations of space, in this age, they know how to overcome the limitations of time, which means things like, what is it from Star Wars, where you go into the little thing and Star Trek, and they dematerialize you and then you remanifest somewhere else. Yogananda says space travel, things like that. It's just like all those limitations which seem to hold us won't hold us anymore. Fascinating to think about, isn't it? So, however, these transition periods, which is where we are right now, are often periods of great turbulence and conflict because there are many embedded and inherent traditions at this point. There are many forms that are not consistent with the new age. I mean, if you're raising a little child and that little child begins to grow out of its shoes, you know, there's nothing wrong with the shoes, but they just don't fit anymore. And the pants will split at the seams and the shoes will wear out at the toes because the form inside is getting too big for the form that was encasing it before, right? So what's happening on our planet right now is that these two forces are interacting with each other and one has to give way to the other in order to create the new reality that Dwapara Yuga is trying to manifest on this planet. A great deal of the old reality has to be obliterated, really, wiped away, changed. Now, just to step back from this again, this is what goes on a planet. And the planet never actually evolves per se, because this is an endless cycle. And if you think in terms of geologic and planetary time, you know, 24,000 years seems like a really long time in human life, but in the age of a planet, it's not really such a long time. But planet Earth never gets completely good because it gets all the way up to the apex of Satya Yuga, and just when it's really got its act together, it begins to come down the other side again. And just when it just looks like it just can't get any worse, it starts up again. So there's never any point at which planet Earth becomes something wonderful, everlastingly. Because it, even though there's a guiding spirit and a certain consciousness, there's, I mean, the idea of guardian angels and guardians of the earth and spirits that run the earth is a true concept. It's the individual guardians that evolve, not the earth itself. The earth itself is just a material object. You see the difference? There's not one individual consciousness that's earth. Earth is not a being that's going to become self-realized. We, however, individually, are beings that are going to become self-realized. The Sanskrit word for our eternal self, it's a very good Sanskrit word, is the word jiva. We often speak of our ego versus our soul, which is an okay way to talk about it, but it's really the individual spark of divinity that goes through all your incarnations. The Sanskrit word for it is jiva. Now that jiva, which is a fragment of infinity, you might say, or a ray of infinity, becomes identified with whatever physical body you've manifested. In fact, it's the jiva itself that brings those material atoms together to make a physical body. And then the individual spark of life within us becomes identified with that physical body and becomes less conscious of its eternal nature and imagines itself to actually be defined by the limited physical form we're living in. It's never actually changed into anything but divinity, but it becomes defined by what it's manifested. Does that, do you follow that? And that word is ego. When the jiva becomes identified, when the jiva, which is eternal and infinite, becomes identified with that which is material and transitory, that is the concept of ego. Ego is the jiva identified with the limited. So we all live in ego consciousness because we are all imagining at the moment that we are physical and limited. Whereas in fact, the very consciousness that imagines that is infinite in its nature. It's just a little confused. Ego is the infinite soul, the jiva, identified with the limited world. Now, the process of personal growth, of self-realization, is the process of ever-increasing awareness. We go from less awareness to more awareness until our awareness becomes infinite. So even in the course of one lifetime, if you think about it, the degree to which you have grown, I have grown, we have grown, is that we've become more aware. We may have thought, for example, when some tough experience came to us, how can I live if my mother dies? And then my mother dies, and I discovered that I can go on, that I'm still alive. How can I live if I lose this job? How can I live if I don't have children? How can I live if I grow old and am no longer a beautiful young man or a beautiful young woman? But if we grow in our lives and don't merely live through it and shrink, some people, the more experiences that come, the more deeply they become identified. My mother has died, my life is over. And then you see them walking around. As they get older and older, they don't get more and more radiant and free. The more blows they have, the more that's taken away from them, the smaller and smaller they get, until finally they give up their body and they get to start all over again. People who actually grow and expand their consciousness through their lives, even as they progress through the years and even as the physical body gets ages, you see the spirit within them gets bigger and bigger. Swami Kriyananda is 85 now. He was like 41 or so when I first met him, 42. And his physical body doesn't work real great anymore. He's not completely debilitated, but he can't walk very far. He needs help up and down stairs. When he travels, he has to move through the airport in a wheelchair. But when he sits down and isn't having to just sort of lug that body around, the spirit just has no limit. There's just no boundaries to his consciousness. It's just completely open. It's actually always been like that. Even when he was young, it's just more apparent now that he's older. Because he's expanded his awareness year by year. And he's less and less identified with all of those limiting things. So the fact that the body is collapsing around him has nothing to do with him. It's just a fact, like wearing a tattered sweater or something like that. And it has holes in it. There's no question about it. But it doesn't have anything to do with who he is. So
85
in about 2 weeks. So when the drama of the individual jiva is the drama of identifying more and more deeply with the infinite and less with the transitory. Okay? And that drama takes more than one incarnation to act out. And we have incarnations in all kinds of ages on all kinds of planets. You know, this whole drama that I'm describing is just what happens on planet Earth. But when Yogananda was asked, do we always reincarnate on the same planet? He said, oh, no. He said, if you did, you would just figure it out too quickly. He said, there's just literally innumerable planets that you can be born into. And all of them are having some cycle of greater and lesser awareness, depending on where they are in their particular cycle. But the drama of individual self-realization just takes place against the background of whatever is going on globally, culturally, nationally, religiously, all of those things. And we choose, as individual souls, and we are magnetized to the place that has exactly the right combination of forces for what we personally need as our next step in order to move forward, or at least to have the opportunity to move forward. Whether we move forward or not depends on how we respond, according to exactly what karmic pattern we have and what will facilitate that. So we step into conditions that are not exactly created by us, but that are perfectly suited to what would help us to increase our awareness. Now, that's why I point out that Jesus and his disciples incarnated at a very low point in history. And as a consequence, Jesus himself was crucified, and almost all his disciples also died in some exceedingly, from our point of view, unpleasant way. Because the world was just too dark for what they were doing. But the opportunity to be with Jesus, to help him in his mission, to plant this divine truth, and then to sacrifice their lives in the attempt to serve others with this truth, was just exactly what was appropriate for them karmically. Now, when the ego is identified with the physical body, with that which is transitory, it has all kinds of opinions about what is good and what is bad. When we actually know ourselves to be the jiva, which is this infinite spirit moving through this creation, what is good and what is bad begins to shift, because the only thing that's good is that which helps us to come back to an understanding of our true identity, that loosens the hold of the ego upon us. And that which is bad is anything which causes us to cling more intensely to all those ego-defined realities, you see? So the concept good karma, bad karma is a very interesting one. We call it bad karma if we're inconvenienced or put into pain or disappointed. We call it good karma if we're not inconvenienced, if we're not, if we get what we want. But is it really good karma to get what you want? Now, I'm going to modify that in a minute. But the whole reality of it changes. So we have chosen, all of us, because we're sitting here, to be on planet Earth at the time when it's going to shift, when it is shifting from Kali into Dwapara. It's a very unstable period to be living in. We were just talking, a few of us, before all of you came in, about bookstores, you know, which you're sitting in one, although you notice that there's a huge number of stuff in here that isn't books anymore. This bookstore used to actually be just a bookstore because it used to be possible to run a very tidy little business selling books. And who would have ever thunk just a few decades ago that the concept of books would be so radically changed? I mean, it just would have almost been a preposterous idea. I remember how excited people were when they got a fax machine. It was just an incredible thing to have a fax machine. And my friend used to talk to me about this way computers could talk to each other. And it was very complicated and very elaborate. And if we set up these certain wires and networks, we could talk to each other. I mean, I could never see any point in it. But he was an inventor, and he saw where it was going. I was talking about an Indian family that my husband used to have his film developed from their little film developing company. And I remember we used to patronize them particularly, and they were a very nice family, and it was comforting to have their little business there. And, of course, they're long gone, totally gone. Who would have ever thought that the whole concept of developing film would just go away? These are very insecure times that we live in. And this bookstore, you know, is struggling to maintain itself because the printing and selling of books, first of all, people buy the shop on the internet, and second of all, they don't even buy books. They buy electronic signals that allow them to read the same material. Now, that's bad if you're in the business. That's great if you're just thinking about future progress and all the things that are potentially true. Now, all of us decided that somehow it would benefit our souls, because you only do things to benefit your soul, really. We all thought it would benefit our souls to be part of this changing reality. Yogananda tells us that it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, that there are these cosmic forces. Now, who knows why, but when an age changes from Kali Yuga to Dwapara Yuga, apparently it's a time of great conflict on the planet. I've been reading a few books about some of the things that go on in Africa, you know, Darfur and some of the things in the Sudan and Rwanda and Sierra Leone. And, you know, we're just sitting here living our lives in a more or less normal way, but people in those countries, the most unimaginably barbaric, totally disruptive things are going on, even just as we sit here, like this. That Kali into Dwapara is a time when demonic forces also get a certain amount of free rein on this planet. And Osama bin Laden was a very good example of someone who absolutely held to this extremely Kali Yuga concept of this is the word of God, this is the way it must be acted out, nobody has a right to be if they're not in conformance with that. You see, all of that is very Kali Yuga. It's one fixed, externally defined reality that will dominate other realities. And then, you know, people on our side of the equation say things like, well, it's a big world, we can all exist together. You know, the same divine spirit lives in all of us. We don't have to be so rigid about these things. Those are all Dwapara Yuga ways of thinking. That's where you're beginning to think not so much about form and about tradition and how it was done in the past and how it has to be done, but about the flow of things and how the energy is and what's the reality behind it. And it meets the Kali Yuga point of view that says, this is the way and this is the only way. We have a pope now, Benedict the 13th or the 17th, whatever his name is. Some of our friends in Italy, they call him whatever it is, B13, as my friend said, as if he were a vitamin. They're not fond of him at all. He's a very, 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 very retro-thinking man. And, you know, he's just going to make that Catholic Church, that Catholic Church used to be the only church. It's the one true way to Christ, it used to rule the world, and by Jove, it's going to rule the world again, as far as he's concerned. And he's just holding on to that. You know, it's, if you read the things that he's written, he's trying to look more like a Dwapara Yuga leader, and he's, you know, trying to enter a mosque and be nice to the Jews, but his actual theology is, He'll be nice to all of us, but unfortunately we're all damned to hell unless we become Catholics, you know, which he'll write privately and then pretend to be something else, but he's just Kali Yuga personified. Just couldn't be more so. And even the whole way the Catholic Church presents itself, which is huge and rich and powerful and authoritarian and all of these things, it's all very Kali Yuga. Dwapara Yuga just doesn't go there. Dwapara Yuga is self-realization. Yogananda came to bring self-realization. What is self-realization? Your spiritual life is your responsibility. No priests, no ritual, no dogma, no intermediaries. Your spiritual life is your responsibility. It's very dwapara. It's not about form, it's about spirit and energy. Now, those two forces are just head-on with each other. And, you know, America's been attacked by that force once because America itself is a Dwapara Yuga country. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, that we were all endowed by God with the same inalienable rights, that each person should be taken just exactly for who they are. I mean, if you only live in this country and don't travel and don't really see how different things are, I was in my mid-30s before I even had a passport, so I never saw any of the world until I was that old. I was just shocked to realize what the world is like because I'd only ever been in America. You know, in America, you arrive with nothing and nothing prevents you except your own initiative from, well, becoming president of the United States if you want to be. You don't, and you go to places, India, Italy, England, where the caste systems are still in place, where class consciousness is still in place, where breeding and tradition is still in place. And you realize that this country is just a complete revolution, which is why everybody wants to come here. And yes, we've got weak points too, but it's completely different. It was not based on form. It was based entirely on energy. So we are the wave of the future, which is why the whole world is flocking to America, and which is why American culture is taking over the world. You can look at these things in one of two ways. You can look at them as if somehow this is terrible, or you can look at them and say, isn't this interesting? Look what God is doing. You know, right now what's being exported from America, well, many things are being exported. It's Burger King and McDonald's and Walmarts and stuff like that, which is not the greatest. But what you actually see is a one-world culture coming into being. Because even the idea of all these separate cultures and languages is a Kali Yuga concept where everything is split apart. In Dwapara Yuga, the underlying energy of our shared reality begins to come together. Indigenous peoples are being wiped out all across the planet. It's just what's happening. And again, you can mourn it, and there's something to be mourned in it, or you can say, isn't this interesting? And the whole story of the Yugas, and I mentioned to you a very good book is about to come out on that subject, maybe next month, which talks about it in ways nothing else has, just really says, look, this is just what happens. You know, once you get into these cycles, there's just this time when the whole planet begins to come together. However, right now, what we have, which is so bizarre, is we have Kali Yuga consciousness with Dwapara Yuga energy. Dwapara has more energy. So what you have is extreme materialism, extreme complexity of laws, you know, just everything is really complicated. It's just an absolute overwhelming amount of information. You know, just the whole practice of medicine is another thing. You know, doctors used to have a secret stash of information. Now the patient goes in with all these printouts from the internet and tells the doctor, and the doctor says, well, what's that reference? I'll go look it up. You know, just so much information that we don't even know what to do with it. And our poor school kids are just completely baffled. They have no idea what to do with all the information they're giving them because we haven't actually transitioned into the clarity that Dwapara Yuga can bring, but we have all that energy in place, but we still are just in a state of complete confusion about how to work with this. So spiritual leaders like Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami Kriyananda begin to come, and many other movements that are all sort of hearkening to where we're going. They're the heralds of where we're going. You know, love the planet, live more simply, be more intentional in what you do, practice random acts of kindness. We can all coexist. And they're all sort of, they sound like sort of just crying into the wind, because you have this other just insanity sort of going on at the same time. I've lived in the Palo Alto area for 25 years teaching for Ananda. And I've just watched, just in my little tiny universe, people's lives just get busier and busier and busier and busier, whereas people used to be able to participate, you know, multiple times a week in Ananda. Now they can make it on the weekends. And it's not that they're less dedicated or less interested. It's just that the Dwapara Yuga energy applied to the Kali Yuga form, you know, we've got to run here and do this, and we have to do all this work, and we have to match all these things. And it's just going to fall to pieces because it's unsustainable and because it's not, that's not really where we're going. Plus, a lot of this stuff, I don't know how else to put it, has to go away. A lot of the whole system has to just tilt over, and so that it can liberate us for another reality. I mean, I go out to buy a pair of sunglasses. You know, sunglasses are $85, $150. People are walking around with thousands of dollars worth of clothes on, and purses and hats and closets full of things. Somebody who was an architect told me, just tracking the size of closets over the last 50 years has just been an incredible statement of how the world has changed. My family was comfortable financially. We weren't poor. As people go, our family was not that materialistic. But I remember my mother's closet, and there wasn't that much in it. You know? She had a couple of nice dresses. And when she went out, she would wear one of her nice dresses. She didn't have 45 nice dresses. She didn't feel she had to buy a new nice dress every single time she went out. She didn't have 20 pairs of shoes for her 25 different dresses. But you know, the mindset, Dwapara Yuga energy in Kali Yuga forms. And then all the requirements to support that, and the houses get bigger and bigger, and every child has to have his own room, and every child has to have his own cell phone, his own computer, his own television, his own car. And then somebody has to support that. And it's exhausting. And in the end, isn't even very satisfying, but it's spinning out of control. Now, and then what's coming with that is greed and a lot of other things. So where we are right now is, the masters tell us, and common sense tells us, everybody but the U.S. government and Fox News tells us, you know, that it's just not going to last. Now, is it going to break tomorrow? I don't know. Is it going to break 5 years from now? I don't know. But is it going to break inevitably? Because what we're doing, it's contrary to where we're going, and I'm presenting this to you very casually, but there's a tremendous amount of evidence behind this. This is a very well thought out and well understood way of speaking about the yugas. But I've also, just from childhood, felt, this is crazy. You know, and a lot of us think, this is just crazy. The way we're living is just crazy. I myself went to a spiritual community at a relatively speaking young age as an adult because it was crazy. I couldn't find a place to enter into this world. And when I saw that Swami Kriyananda was starting a completely alternative society, I just ran over to be part of it. And I've been part of it my whole adult life because it made sense to me. It was something I wanted to give my energy to. Much more simple, much more cooperative, much more God-centered, much more value-oriented. And, you know, I've still lived. I've lived 25 years of my life, of my 40 years of Ananda, right here in Palo Alto, which is like an ironic sort of thing. But Palo Alto is the center of Dwapara Yuga because it's here from which both ideas and inventions emanate. I mean, virtually the whole New Age has been created from the Bay Area in a very real sense. Because we're very forward-looking here. And we have a lot of Dwapara Yuga energy applied to Kali Yuga forms too. Now, all of that, what we see now, is that the sheer unsustainability of it And the tremendous desire for something deeper and different has begun to just simply crack through. But we're still kind of helpless in it. It's like we can't quite get off the treadmill. But there's all these forces pushing to change it. Years ago, Swami Kriyananda said something that was so interesting. He said there are certain karmic groups that have reincarnated in America right now. And he said the Atlanteans, and Atlantis, the legend of Atlantis was the apex of Satya Yuga. And then the legend of Atlantis is that somehow or another it became so imbalanced that the whole continent sank. We haven't actually found sunken Atlantis, but people keep trying to find it. It's an ancient legend that the masters say is true. And the reason they say it sank is because the scientists developed so much power, and they began to use that power in a way that was not honorable. And they basically put the whole culture so out of balance that eventually... See, you can't just disregard divine law indefinitely. Sooner or later, it catches up with you. It may appear that you can get away with it, but sooner or later, it catches up with you. Yogananda remarked about Joseph Stalin, whom he said was, you know, the incarnation of evil, in essence. He said, for what Joseph Stalin did, he said he will have 100,000 lifetimes of suffering. Now, he wasn't cursing him. He was just saying that Joseph Stalin murdered millions of his own people. He says Hitler was, and I told this, that what Yogananda put it, was a Boy Scout by comparison to Stalin's. Hitler's the one who's vilified. Stalin was even our ally for a while. But he did so much evil. And he also, comparing Hitler and Stalin, which is just the master's point of view, he said Hitler was the instrument of the karma of his country and the karma of the Jews. Stalin was personally responsible for the grief that he inflicted. This is only a master could perceive the difference. But, you know, Stalin died in a terrible state of mind, but he's, you know, a tremendous number of things are going to happen to him. You see people who are caught in terrible karmic circumstances, but nothing is an accident. It's all just things balancing. America, the whole world, has been just disregarding karmic law for really quite a long time. We've been acquiring for ourselves. We've been raping the planet. We've violated. Well, you start with the founding of America, which was very noble overall. But Yogananda said the really bad karma that America got was the way we treated the American Indians. Because we just came in and just, it was their destiny. It was the end of their time. So we were the instrument of their karma. But Americans behaved with extraordinary dishonor for entirely out of greed. And we're, you know, we're completely just continuously murdered, confined, stole, and lied to those people until we had destroyed them because we wanted what they had. Now, that karma didn't hit us immediately because America was also founded for very noble purposes, for personal freedom, for religious freedom, to empower individuals to create this whole Dwapara Yuga reality. And even those who were mistreating the Indians also had this expansive vision of the country that America was going to become. So it wasn't instant karma because the intentions were mixed, but it was bad karma. And Yogananda said that dissonance has been circling around and it's going to have to be paid off, is what he said. He said, overall, America has very good karma. And he says, America may struggle, but will not be defeated. We will not be overcome by tyrants. We will not lose our way of life. We will not be obliterated. I mean, societies are obliterated all the time. I mean, in our own time, the Israelis, the Jews just went in and took Palestine. You know, I mean, they just took it. As Swami Kriyananda says, it might not be that laudable, but they did it. People do it all the time. You just go in and you take somebody's country. And then it becomes your country. And after a few hundred years, it's your country and the people that you took it from. We came in and took it from the Indians. I mean, these things happen. But he said America will not be taken over.
They
Pardon me? Yeah.
Is there anything to stake?
It was complex. you know, and the Palestinians are now, they're trying to figure out, but that bad karma has haunted them. Of course, that whole question is very, very complicated, and so that's a whole nother issue. But, you know, I'm just saying these things happen, and the complexity of it has to work itself out karmically, but you don't just get away with it. And the way we have dealt with this planet, the planet is beginning to give us hurricanes, it's beginning to give us tornadoes, it's beginning to give us earthquakes and famines, you know, and these things are happening because we have created a great deal of dissonance, and that dissonance has an expression. And we have also created an economy that is just based on such a frantic materialism that it's not in keeping even with our own happiness. And as a result, Yogananda says, it's going to start coming apart. I mean, it's being brought down by greed. This whole crazy business with the mortgages and all of that, which I only understand very... But what was that? That was people saying, oh, look, more for me, more for me, more for me, more for me. And you do that for a while, but then it has to shift. Now, having said all of those awful things, here we are as individuals, and we still have one responsibility. Wherever we are, whatever planet we're on, whatever age we're living in, we have one responsibility: to identify more with spirit and less with ego, to expand our identity from the small individual concerns of this infinite self being in the physical body, and to know ourselves more and more as the infinite spirit. Now, in order to really become powerful at that, we have to be challenged. I mean, I don't like to go to the gym, and I but at different times in my life I have worked out at the gym. You know, you're sitting there working on those weights, and you keep increasing the weight. Because if you don't keep increasing the weight, nothing's going to happen. And this whole planet is like a spiritual gymnasium in which we hit a sort of comfortable zone, and then the weight has to increase. Jesus put it very simply. He said, it's not enough merely to love those who love you. He says, even the Pharisees and the tax collectors do that. I mean, that's no accomplishment. You have to love those who hate you. You have to love those who despitefully use you. He said, that's what it really is to be his disciple. And so we say, oh, well, I love God as long as he gives me really nice things and leaves me alone to have my life exactly as I want it. Aren't I good? But he wants us to be able to feel that divine presence no matter what circumstances we're in. Now, I don't like to go to the gym. I don't like to strain against those heavy weights. I don't consider it much fun. You know, so I found other ways to exercise my body. But a lot of us think, I don't want to have to strain. I don't want to have to exercise my spiritual muscles. I don't want to have to increase my awareness. I don't want to have to conquer my preferences. I don't want to have to resist my ego's desire to be comfortable. And God says, gee, I'm sorry about that. But, well, this is Mother's Day weekend, so a good mother, you know, a little child says, I don't want to go to school. I like being a baby. I want to just stay here with you. My friend was trying to potty train her little 2-year-old or so, whatever age you potty train children, I'm not a mother, two. And he just wasn't interested. And she was trying to persuade him. She said, don't you want to be a big boy? And he looked at her with such surprise. And he said, no, mommy, I love being a baby. It was just like, I'm really not interested in growing up. Of course, he's 30 now, and he did eventually get potty trained, you know, when he was ready. But he wanted to be a baby. He liked being a baby. So, but she backed off a little, but when the time came, you know, she got him to understand what he needed to do when he was ready. Okay, we're Divine Mother's children. We think that we're here living all by ourselves, but we're not. We're Divine Mother's children, and she's training us. She's training us to be like her. You know, Divine Mother's the image of God. It's a sweet way of talking about God. She's training us. And we say, oh, no, Mommy, I don't want to grow. I want to be a baby. I like it here. I like having things just comfortable. I think I'm big enough. And she says, oh, honey, I'm sorry. You know, you have a destiny. And it's my job. It's my responsibility. It's my love for you. I'm not going to let you stay in diapers, spiritually speaking. And if you don't willingly cooperate, then I'm just going to have to set a fire underneath you, one way or another. So we think it's bad karma when Divine Mother takes an interest in us and says, oh, look, I'm, you know, it's time for you to grow again. It's time for you to become bigger than you were. And the way in which the masters tell us that God is going to work with this whole planet is he's going to change the system. And he's going to change the system through difficulties. You know, there are 30,000 known nuclear weapons on the planet right now, and that doesn't even count the ones that aren't known. And there's so much violence and so much hatred and so much demonic energy in all directions. You know, we've held it away from our shores with the single exception of 9/11. That's the only time war has ever come to this land. Just think how many countries have been at war and how much has happened. It's never touched us. You know, but nuclear weapons will change all of that. And sooner or later, with all the hatred that there is in the world right now, somebody's going to do it. And now I started at the beginning by saying reality is, circumstances are attracted to you by magnetism. And words alone are just words. To say there are 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world and there's a lot of hatred in the world and somebody's going to use one of those is not to make it happen. To observe what is true is neither being negative nor judgmental nor fearful. You know, it's like, I'm hungry, I need to eat. I don't have any money in my wallet, I have to go to the ATM. These are not negative statements, these are simply facts that have to be dealt with. And on the planet right now, certain conditions exist. And it behooves us to notice them. Now, as for our personal response, we have one responsibility, and that responsibility is to increase our personal awareness of the divine presence within. That divine presence, the nature of that divine presence is Satchidananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. And that is our magnetism. And our magnetism is what affects both our circumstances and the circumstances of all those we have the capacity to touch with our magnetism. In every disaster or difficult situations, there are always these amazing stories of individual experiences. And all of those individual experiences are determined by the karmic magnetism of every individual involved. You know, I can't give you the details specifically, but, you know, the story of, which was a true story, of a man in the courtroom giving his closing argument, and all of a sudden he had such a thing in his throat, he had to walk out of the courtroom and go all the way outside just to cough and cough. In that moment, there was a landslide, and the building was obliterated, but he was drawn out of the building. You know, the person who has a ticket for the plane that goes down, there was a plane that from Chicago a few years ago, and everybody was killed when that plane crashed. The mother of a friend of ours in California, her mother had a ticket for that plane. But a couple of days before, the daughter called up and said, you know, Mom, this just isn't a good time to visit. And the daughter couldn't even say exactly why, but it just wasn't a good time to visit, so she canceled her ticket. You know, otherwise she would have been on that plane. And many stories. You know all of those things, because there's even a story I heard recently that when the atomic bomb was dropped on one of those Japanese cities, there was a small group of either nuns or monks or some kind of a spiritual group that was right in the destruction zone, and their ashram place was not destroyed. It's just like you can't even think about it. How do you plan that? It was just the magnetism. There's several stories I've heard of volcanic lava parting around a church and going past it instead of going through it. So the only thing that we can do, because the purpose of difficulties is to cause us to expand our awareness so that we can remain in touch with the reality of bliss within us, no matter what our external circumstances. So no matter what's happening to us externally, the answer to it always is to have a deeper awareness of inner bliss. Now, we achieve that by meditation, by devotion, by prayer, and by using our energy to help others. Because one of the ways in which one experiences inner bliss is to identify with others as deeply as you identify with yourself, and then to use your energy to uplift. And not only does that make us feel better, but that's the whole point of the lesson. That's why the whole thing is happening to the planet, is because way too much greed, way too much self-interest, and that has to be corrected. And by this point, it's going to be a rather violent correction, at least so everyone tells us. If you're sitting where all those hurricanes and tornadoes are, if you were in New Orleans during Katrina, it would already have hit you. We're just living right now, we're beginning to live the economic side of it, and even that hasn't quite caught up with us. We're sort of ratcheting down like this, but we haven't really taken a plunge. I mean, there are many people who are seriously unemployed or underemployed, but it hasn't reached the level of hundreds of homeless on the street or anything yet, but who knows? Now, if we fear it, that's a bad idea, because the magnetism of fear, that's what, and it's not really like, oh, how horrible, you're afraid and it comes to you. It's like fear is a preoccupation with a certain condition, and that becomes a magnetic force which draws it to you. Also, that which you are afraid of, sooner or later you have to face. So the more you fear something, the more you guarantee that sooner or later you get to overcome that fear. When I asked Swamiji once about karma, he said, well, if you, the two things that bind you karmically are if you regret or if you long for something. Longing and regret are what bind you. And longing, fear fits in there, because you either regret that happened and you don't want it to happen again, you become anxious about it. Fear is a form of those, because fear preoccupies you, you're not at peace. And naturally, we're all afraid of many things. Longing or regret are the things that bind us the most. Pardon me?
How do they affect us?
They bind you. If you deeply long for something, you have to reincarnate to experience it. If you deeply regret something, you have to reincarnate to resolve your guilt or your shame over it. And the other thing, truthfully, is if you're afraid of something, there's karma that still has to be worked out. Because in a state of Satchitananda, you fear nothing. Because if you know that God is everywhere and all is bliss, what is there to fear? So the extent to which you fear, also there is unresolved karma. But to say that... Go ahead. Say again.
Is that a negative or positive?
If what?
Thing? I'm sorry. Binding.
Well, binding causes you to identify with something other than perfect bliss. And the extent to which you identify with something other than perfect bliss, you suffer. So it's negative in your experience. Yes, but there is also the tradition of transcending it by becoming self-realized. And that is the tradition that Yogananda created, and also that was the message of Christ also. All true spiritual masters have told us that we can transcend all suffering and live only in bliss. Now that sounds like...
I haven't accepted Jesus as a true spiritual
master. Right. I mean... You don't have to accept it. It's the premise from which I'm speaking, because I do accept it, and it's the message of my teachers, and it's a message that I believe in, so I share it. But it is an impossible message to convert anybody to, because you either feel it and understand and want to go there, or you don't. So we advertise, so to speak. But we don't try to convert. We advertise in the sense that if you're interested in this, we'll talk to you about it. But if you're not interested in this, we certainly aren't going to chase you to the other side of the world and try to persuade you, because this is self-realization. Self-realization is not about priests, rituals, dogmas, or condemnation. It's completely one's own personal experience and how you relate to that experience and how that experience motivates you and what you want to do with it. Fair enough. Yes, Christina. Right.
Do you have to go through, do you have to work through every single fear, every single, or is there a higher way of understanding the concept without you actually having to walk through it negatively yourself? Can you
right.
observe someone else and go, you know, I don't think I want to go there.
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying. Okay. Yogananda makes the terrifying statement that in order to overcome, in order to recognize what will and will not fulfill it, that we have to experience it ourselves. Now I'd said a little while ago that, you know, bad karma, good karma, but we learn more from being fulfilled than we do from having our desires frustrated. Because if we want something and we think it'll make us happy, we don't get to find out, we'll always at least believe a little bit that it will. So it is good karma to be successful, be able to manifest your desires, to have enough money to buy what you want. And the reason it's good karma is because then we can find out sort of just how much fulfillment there is in these things. If we still imagine it's going to make us happy, we're going to have to go and drink that cup. Now, however, we've had so many lifetimes up until now. I know some psychics will tell you, oh, you're an old soul, you've had 500 lifetimes. Yogananda said we've had millions of lifetimes. So by the time you're sitting in here dealing with something like this, you've been through a lot already. And so when you see somebody else doing something and are able to learn just by looking, that means because you've actually already been there. And when you see it manifested to you again, you don't really have to go there because you know you don't want to. Now, sometimes conditions that we don't, that are not desirable to us are still given to us because the Divine Mother knows that this is the right combination for us to learn something that the ego may not yet be able to grasp. However, if we really start thinking about and counting like that, we do become overwhelmed. But that's where the guru and a practice like Kriya Yoga really come in. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda, without explaining Kriya, talks about the tremendous spiritual benefit of the practice of Kriya. Now, the practice of Kriya is something that you just do yourself. You don't need a priest. It's not a ritual. And what you're doing is you're working with the level of your own being, which is the chakras, in which the karmic pattern is imprinted. Okay, so if you have a karmic inclination, like a deep desire to be a movie actress, that you wanted for so many lifetimes, your sister was a movie actress, your mother was a movie actress, you really wanted to be a movie actress, you failed, I want to be a movie actress. There's a vritti, a vortex of energy inside of you that still desires this. But it exists as a vortex of energy. Kriya Yoga is a technique through which you can dissolve that vortex. And if you can dissolve the vortex, then the karma never has to be lived through. The guru also can magnetize you in such a way that lots of those karmic vortexes are dissolved without having to be lived through. And that's how, in the end, that's called the grace of God. That's how in the end it's the grace of God that finally frees you. Because if we actually had to live through each of one of those things, you start living through it and you start creating another one. You start living through this and you start creating another one. But at a certain point, you basically get the whole picture. And you know that you don't want ice cream anymore, so you don't have to say, no, I don't want raspberry, no, I don't want strawberry, no, I don't want chocolate, no, I don't want lemon, no, I don't want ginger chocolate, you know. It's like you don't have to do each one. You've just got the concept, ice cream doesn't really make me feel good anymore. And at, when you sort of begin to get it in a more global sense, then you begin to attract to yourself the techniques, the opportunities, the teachers that allow you to work at it from a completely different level than you're working at it when you're just rolling along, just trying to figure out whether being a murderer is a good idea or being a, you know, an exotic dancer is a good idea or a car salesman is a good idea. We're still playing out a certain amount of that, but we're not, we've moved a little bit beyond some of that. Now we get to find out whether being poor and unemployed is really an obstacle to our happiness, whether or not conceivably being in a nuclear holocaust is really going to be our happiness, whether or not living in a in one room with five people because that's all we can afford is our happiness. I mean, I just don't know where this is going to go. If there is nuclear holocaust, a lot of us won't be here to even worry about it. We'll just be in the astral world, and that won't really be a problem. You know, once we're gone, we're gone. And if it is our karma to live, then we'll just live through it. Yes? Yeah.
I heard Swami Kriyananda say something about the government. He thinks the government is going to get smaller, talking about America.
Right.
To me, that suggests that, well, all the left and right, you know, argument right. in current politics is about shrinking because the government spends too much. And it kind of put me in mind of the idea of government having sort of encroached on the role of religion in a way.
Yes.
You know, tithing used to be a concept of religion.
Right.
And now, you know, social programs are like
right.
what we expect from government.
Right.
You know, care of widows and orphans used to be a biblical concept.
Right.
The priestly class.
Right.
So that sort of makes me think that maybe what's in the immediate future is this argument about shrinking government and
right.
cutting back on
right.
programs. Cutting back on health care, reorganizing health care.
All those things now, see, all the variability even to have all those things is based on enormous disposable wealth. I was in India. We used to lead pilgrimage tours to India over, we started in like 1987, and we did it for about 20 years, which were very, very big changing years in India. So India is much more modernized than when we started. In one of our earlier trips, we got caught in a fire. We were in this temple where they had a temporary structure put up. Temporary, I mean, it held several thousand people, but it was just, you know, bamboo sticks and things like that. But there was electricity in there, and there are no codes. Thing caught fire. To make a long story short, we were mostly all, nobody got seriously hurt. A few people got some burns, but nothing that serious. We all got out. The fire department showed up, and I'm not kidding you. This is like this pondola is what it's called. It was like half a football field in size, and it was about a three-story building. It was flaming, you know, just flames way up. We're watching it flame. The fire department arrives. Pickup trucks full of men in little singletons and shorts and bare feet and buckets. And they formed a bucket line, and they started throwing water at this three-story fire. Fortunately, the truth was, and they knew it, it was sort of in an open area. The permanent structure was all concrete. Everything was just straw and wood. It burned out in a matter of like half an hour, and it never ignited anything else. It just, and they all knew that because these temple fires are really common because there's blah, blah, blah. Our American group was absolutely, totally freaked. It was our second day in India. They were just beyond themselves. And, you know, we sent them back to the hotel and this whole thing. And they're just sitting there just scared to death and like, I want to go home. I want to go home where there's, you know, $30 million worth of fire equipment sitting in my neighborhood just in case my oven catches fire. It's like there's not $30 million of extra money in India because people are starving. You can't spend $30 million on fire equipment just in case. It's just not possible. We don't even know that. We don't even know it's not possible because we have so much money. We have no idea how much money we have. So I think, according to, as I understand it, all of those issues are going to solve themselves because, you know, right now the government's printing the money to make it work. But sooner or later, that's going to all catch up. And if it comes down as far as they say, it'll have to go back into the hands of individuals where it more naturally belongs. But Kali Yuga consciousness in Dwapara Yuga energy has caused this thing to swell and swell and swell and swell. And America has amazing karma, so we've had the money to do it. If we don't have the money, really don't have the money, then the whole thing will be different. And yeah, it'll come down just like that. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, very interesting. Yes.
Is it possible to have the Kali Yuga know how, but the spirit of the
Dwapara Yuga? Okay, what do you mean by
Kali? When you want to build, let's say, a spiritual community.
Right.
And you know the demonic energy is very strong. Well, you practice loving.
Right.
You say love even the one that hates you, the one that wants to destroy your
world. Right.
Like, you're trying to build all this and then come in.
Yeah, the dark always tries to pull down the light.
You want to love them. So how do you love them but not let them destroy?
Well, see, you're again, here you have to think about what's really true. If people are really doing something that's really inappropriate, when the mother sees a child doing something really inappropriate, it's not love to be gentle at that point. At that point, you pick the child up by the scruff of the neck and you take them out of there and you put them in the room and you slam the door shut. Because that's how you love the child who's really doing something wrong. You don't love him by just letting him go on. So a lot of times people think that love means you have to be nice. No, you have to be appropriate.
Right, that's what
you have to be very appropriate.
That's what I struggle because the teachings say, be tolerant.
No, the teachings do not say be tolerant. No, no.
So
are you listening to me?
Yeah.
That's a false teaching.
Right. Yeah, that's
it's a false teaching. You know, there is such a thing as wrong action, wrong energy, wrong in the sense that it violates divine principles. And for you as a so-called spiritual person, for anybody in the name of so-called spirituality, to allow that to go on, now where you love is, you don't hate that person, you don't wish him ill, you don't want him to be destroyed, you're not trying to do vengeance on him, but you're going to stop him. You're going to stop him if it's personal, if this is a drunken spouse who's behaving completely inappropriately. You will change the locks on your doors and get them out of your house. But you want him to be well. You would rejoice if he got well. You're not trying to hurt him, but you have to be appropriate. Nice is not in the Bible. You know, look at the way Jesus behaved. He was not nice. He was fearless and fierce. But as soon as somebody reformed, it's great, you know, I welcome you back. It's only your behavior I'm responding against. Now, people teach differently, and it's just not true. You know, they say, oh, well, we should love the terrorists. You know, Osama bin Laden's not really so bad. Yes, he's really that bad. And don't be afraid to say it. But don't harden your heart. Just be appropriate.
That's such a good topic.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I don't want to say just women. I really feel it with a lot of women not really getting that clarity
right.
on what you're talking about. That is important.
Yeah.
I don't feel that clear on either how to actually, in a situation, I love what you said, though. That really helped kind of started the ball rolling in that direction.
Yeah. You think of it, all true love is mother love. The highest form of love is mother love. Now, that's it does not, in our culture, we worship the temptress, you know, in terms of female. Ideal female love in America is the temptress, whereas in truth, it's the mother. And for men or women, all the highest form of love is mother love, because mother love is self-sacrificing for the welfare. But true mother love can be really tough. And, you know, a mother who doesn't have the courage to really raise her child, that's not loving. That's just sheer cowardice or laziness. I mean, sometimes you get a lemon, so I don't want to hold every mother responsible for every bad child. But if you don't have the nerve to really be a mother, and so somebody's behaving improperly, you don't serve them by letting them get away with it. and you have to have, but you never stop loving. See, that's why it's mother love. The mother always loves the child, always. But I'm doing this because this is the right thing. Yeah, people get very confused, and you're right, Christina. Women get confused, but men also. People just, the word is appropriate. You have to respond appropriately. And sometimes you're also important. Sometimes your lesson is to stand up. And so your margin of what is tolerable for you can be much narrower than someone else's. Ramakrishna, one disciple, was traveling on a boat and someone insulted Ramakrishna on the boat. And the disciple was a big man. It was a small boat. He began to rock the boat. He said, "Take that back or I'll sink this ship and drown all of us." You know, he was just furious. And when he landed on the shore of the river, Ramakrishna was this great saint in the 1800s. He met his disciple and he said, "Really, was it necessary to get so excited over that fool's words?" You know, but then another disciple who was, I guess, traveling on the same boat and heard somebody insulting Ramakrishna and just quietly sat there. When he got to the shore, Ramakrishna's weeping. "Will no one defend me? Do you not care what they say about me? You say that you love me, and then you let me be insulted and never say a word." Because that man needed courage to stand up. One needed to control his temper. The other needed to develop a little bit of gumption in the face of wronghood. So it just depends on where you're standing. Everybody needs to come to the center. And you can be going opposite directions to get to the center. So that's why you have to do what's appropriate.
Yeah, and the delicacy is that it's not as obvious that the other side is bad, like the song of the ladder. If it's that bad, to stop it. It just maybe, it could be the ego manifests in a certain way. And also, you yourself also have certain ego reactions. So I do understand that you do have to observe yourself. Am I reacting it from my own ego, from my own fear?
But even still, even if your attitude isn't perfect, it's better to act on it than to allow something that's really wrong to go on. You know, you have to balance all the factors. Even if your attitude isn't perfect, sometimes it's just necessary for you to act anyway. It's the best you can do. It's better. I mean, because sometimes people just, it's always my fault. I know that I'm not. But it's just, you have to just be impersonal enough to balance it out. You may not be perfect, but neither is this one, and you need to respond. Yeah, you can't always just make it your own fault, because at a certain point, it isn't your fault. At a certain point, your fault is the tendency to always think that it's your fault, and it's not appropriate to keep going there. You have to stand up. And at a certain point, you don't give them the benefit of the doubt because you need to stand up. And in order to tell that, you need help from the outside. Everybody needs, sometimes if you find yourself in a situation, you have to get some objective third party to help you figure that out. But a lot of times, spiritual people are not nice. When Jesus picked up the whips and drove the money changers out of the temple, he was not being nice, not at all. But it was just needed. And masters sometimes are fierce. Or they scold their disciples because that's how a good mother behaves. Yes?
The next question is that you say there is Kali Yuga's energy. So if I could paint it like, let's say, corporation or a profit, etc. So is it possible to be the dark energy within that corp in order to institute a change?
Well, there's several factors. How strong is your capacity to create change versus how strong is that group's capacity to remain just as it is?
Right.
You can influence within a small sphere or larger, depending how powerful you are. Mm-hmm. And each person has to simply be where they're meant to be. It's not an abstract principle. And also you have to be practical. You have a family to support and this is your job. So you try to do your job in as elevated a way as possible because leaving it just may not be an option.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for the energy. You say that shift, that energy is working out, right? And I'm waiting for the right moment. So where are we in that chart? Is it
Dwapara Yuga.
Prepare yourself until that moment comes.
It's not a yesterday it was Kali Yuga, today it's Dwapara. That's not true.
Yes.
We're already 120 years into it. It shifted at 19. It began to shift in 1700. It shifted, there's a transition period. It shifted in 1900. And we are fully into Dwapara Yuga, but it's 1200. I think it's about 2400 years. And so we're just at the very beginning of it. So we have a long ways to go, and we're not going to see the end of it. We're just going to live through a transition. There's not going to be a moment in which it goes from bad to good. It's a gradual shift. And some things are just going to go away. They're never going to change. They're just going to go away.
Just to improve the chance of success. Or maybe sometimes, you know, the storm is so bad, so just go duck and cover yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And just save your energy until the right time.
Right.
And looking, is there a way to study this to know?
No, I know. No. Because this is a very long, slow cycle, and you're talking about a very tiny piece of time, and there's no definition. You could study astrology, and you might find a better moment, because that deals with more smaller pieces of time. But what the main thing is, work on yourself. Work on yourself, and then, as much as possible, radiate that positive energy outward, and you will do your part. How far that will manifest and how much will happen depends on the karma of the whole situation, which I certainly don't have the eyes to see. I have no idea. But if you do your part, then that will be the best guarantee of what you hope to have happen. I don't want to hold you. I've held you all much longer than I usually do. I'm happy to keep answering questions. But if you feel you need to leave, go right ahead. And if you don't want to leave, we'll just keep going. But I do want you to know that you are free to leave at this point without being rude. Do you have any other questions? Or remind me of your name again.
Holly,
yes, of course. I've met you many times. Yeah, I just couldn't quite pull it out. I was going to say Olivia, but that just didn't sound right. Holly, nice to see you again. Is that fair? Is that a fair answer to the question? Yeah. Anyone else? Any other questions or thoughts? All right.
This
was recorded.
Oh, it was.
And everything that I do is posted on the Ananda Palo Alto website. And if you just type in my name, Asha Praver or Naya Swami Asha, I have a website with just called Naya Swami Asha. Or you can go to Ananda Palo Alto website, and if you pick up our brochure at the front, it has that. If you go to the Ananda Palo Alto homepage. Up at the right, it says Talks and Newsletters by Asha. Click on that, and you will find hundreds of hours of me talking. And it's all MP3 free downloads.
And
this talk will be posted there. There's another talk that I gave in here, which was completely different, which is called something like almost the same topic. It has the word God and the word recession in it. And it's posted on that website.
And last time you were here?
No, it was maybe a year ago.
Oh.
Actually,
it was April 2009. I looked it up. After
thank you. Okay, it was April 2009. And it was a complete... Yeah, it's completely different than this one.
I tried to scribble as fast as I could, but it would be so nice to go back and listen. It's so much richness there.
Well, I'm very glad you feel that way. It's usually because I usually pack so much in, it's just easier to record it and people can hear it. And we just give it all away. I mean, I just want people to... It's a great pleasure to me that the internet exists. I love Dwapara Yuga. Here we are. You know, I mean, Alan emailed me yesterday, and I was talking on giving a webinar yesterday. I mean, it's so much fun. I can sit in my living room. I talk into this little black hole, and people all over the world are there at exactly the same moment. It's so much fun. I love it. Holly, yes. Oh, I think it's fantastic.
Uh-huh. The Kali Yuga forces are So why don't we use it to...
Oh, but we are. We are using it enormously. I mean, I never finished that thought about the different karmic groups that are on the planet. I just realized I didn't. I started with the Atlantean scientists who sank Atlantis, and Swami Kriyananda. I mean, this was actually, he was partly whimsical, but also true. He said that same group is here, and they're doing it again. They're creating, you know, more and more out-of-sync uses of science, you know, just moving us away from a God-centered, harmonious way of being. And that whole group is here again, creating weapons and all that, you know, mass destruction and biological warfare, all that. They're doing all that again. Then another group that's incarnated is in America, this is all in America, is the really, really degenerate Romans who brought down that society from just complete moral bankruptcy. And those people are in charge of Hollywood. They're in charge of the entertainment industry and that whole reality. Then in America, there are two kinds of Indians. There are the American Indians, and especially in the, he was saying this in the 70s, who were all born rich enough to go buy their lands back and go out and live in them. And that was that whole, like, back to the land movement. That's the whole ecology group. That is the Native Americans reincarnated back in this country trying to get the message across that was ignored the first time. And then there are East Indians, people from India who are traditionally more attuned to that Indian philosophy, and they're people like me and others of us who are just completely at home with this, with the ideals of the Himalayan yogis. I mean, this woman was sort of saying, well, I never really accepted all of this, and gosh, I was 19, and when the first time I heard self-realization, it says, that's it, that's what I've been looking for, because I'm Indian in an American body in the sense that I'm a Himalayan yogi in my way of thinking about life. And even just my thought, why bother to acquire anything? What's the point? I mean, I was just born with those thoughts. Now, what Swami said is that the Romans and the Atlanteans are the ones who seem to be in charge, and they don't actually know that we're here. You know, they don't take us seriously as a force, because we don't seem to have the kind of power that they have. Now, he said this in the 70s, and this is after 40 years, we have a little more power. Like Walmart is going to carry organic food. We have a little more power than we had in the 70s when we were starting. But he said that the Atlanteans and the Romans are going to bring the whole thing down again, you know, with the science, the bad technology and the moral bankruptcy is going to bring the whole thing down again, at which point the Indians of both kinds will rise. And the Atlanteans and the Romans that were left will be very surprised to see us because they don't know we're here. And they don't understand how much power these movements really have and how much of people's hearts these movements own right now. But it's just not our karmic moment yet. Right now what we're doing is we're laying a foundation. And so the other side of this whole discussion is that this kind of understanding, harmony with God, harmony with nature, harmony with self, you know, simplicity, all the things that are values, they're self-evident values to people, is the reason why all of this is happening. So, as I was saying earlier, if we're not willing to change first, Divine Mother lights a fire under us. So all we have to do is get ahead of the change, get ahead of the conflagration. And it won't need to touch us in that way because we'll already be there. And so Divine Mother won't have to punish us to teach us because we're already going where we're supposed to be going. That doesn't mean it will be easy because, you know, change takes a lot of energy. And if a lot of other people suffer, sensitive people suffer with them. But it still won't be such a shock to you. I now, in my life, I live in a very comfortable home in, you know, a nice part of the world here. For the first 10 years of my spiritual life, I lived in a trailer that was smaller than this platform that I'm standing on, where the ceiling was not any higher. We do these energization exercises, which involve standing up and going like that. Well, I couldn't do it inside because the ceiling was too low. I couldn't quite touch both walls, but close. No running water, no electricity. I literally earned $50 a month, what Swami Kriyananda would give me out of his wallet. I lived a lot on popcorn, you know, popcorn and peanut butter. I never thought twice about it. I mean, I like to think I could just go back and live like that. I mean, now you need electricity for your computer and you need a satellite for your internet. But so, you know, there's certain things we've grown accustomed to, but having that in my background, I loved living like that. It was actually a great sacrifice to give up that way of life. It was just so simple. It was so harmonious. It was just right in the middle of a forest. It was absolute bliss. I would love to go back to that. So, you know, if in your own heart, either by the way you live or the way you have lived or the way you're living now, you're living lightly and you're living in your spirit, then come what may, you know, you always have that. Let's see what happens. Oh, absolutely. Oh my God, sometimes I look at this house I live in, we live in this, in the community where we live in this house because it's a community center. And David and I, my husband and I, are the only ones who are willing to live in that house and have it also be a public building. You know, everybody else who lived in it was too protective, understandably. But oh, Lordy, it's just, there's so much of it. It's such a big distance. I mean, it's just a two-story house, not even a big house. But the distance from the bedroom to the kitchen is just more than I feel like walking. It's just like, who needs it? But I'm happy to be there. It's a service to be there. It's a beautiful place. It serves a lot of people. And I'm not immune to beauty. I like it. But it's not necessary. It's just where we are now.
But if you feel that your work can impact more people,
you feel that you need the financial support to be here, you have this place, you know, to have the internet, you have the website to be able to give away all the... Holly, let me answer it this way. Simple living is simply having what you need. Okay? If you need to do a work that involves certain realities, I mean, I live in that house because I need to live in that house because in order to be able to have the right setting to run the community, to be able to have the group come over, to be able to have a place where the community can meet, to have a nice atmosphere for lots of things to happen, I need to live in that house. I can't live in the trailer that I used to live in because I can't be part of Ananda Palo Alto in a trailer like that because nobody in Palo Alto would respect that. And Swami Kriyananda himself, at a certain point, I put this story in the book, he used to drive this car, which was a $75 Army surplus car. And we came down here to go to some big program, and there was a big spiritual scene, and all of these other spiritual teachers were at this program. And we parked that car, and there were Mercedes and limos and Cadillacs. People were into a lot of money. But Swami looked around, and he said, I have to get a new car. He said, in India, they would respect me for driving this car because they understand. In this country, where money is so easy to come by, they think there must be something wrong with what I'm doing or else I'd drive a better car. But he didn't go buy a Mercedes. He bought a Ford. You know, he just bought a car that was appropriate for his life, but he said, I need to present myself in such a way that people will respect what I'm doing. If he'd bought a Mercedes, in my opinion, that would not have been the right message. But he just couldn't drive that junker anymore because people didn't understand. I couldn't live in a trailer without electricity and water because most people couldn't do that. And that would send the wrong message of what we're doing. Does that make sense? Right. So you just have to be appropriate. Yes, Alan, what were you going to say?
If the idea of intentional communities is an oncoming idea for the future, does Ananda Palo Alto look towards having a rural setting as like an escape room?
We would absolutely love to have a rural community. We've tried for years to figure out how to acquire one, but land prices and zoning. We almost got a place in Boulder Creek at one point. There was a place that we found which was just the right size and which was affordable, and we were going to put in an offer, and they took it off the market. But most of what is brought to us is so expensive, we just don't have the resources right now. But if there were any way that that could be accomplished, and also in this area, it has to be zoned for a group, because changing the zoning in this area is impossible, and doing it underground is not possible. So it has to be a conference center or a camp. And we haven't committed ourselves to acquiring that with the kind of willpower that we have committed to other things. I have to admit that. But if it were, partly because it hasn't felt within our reach, even the community we live in, we don't own. We merely lease it. What we own is our church. And we've worked hard. It's sort of like the temple for us is the point from which everything emanates, and our resources and most of what we do has gone into that. The community supports it. And then this rural, we've touched it over the years, many different times we've touched it, but we've never actually been able to bring it out of the astral world. But if you have any good ideas, let me know, because we really do need it.
I'm very interested in that idea because, first of all, I was able to retire a couple of years ago, and I'm pretty well situated in terms of just, you know, my own situation, and I'm sort of interested in my next move
right.
in life, because being retired, you know, in America, being retired is sort of like you're in a separate track
right.
out of the mainstream in some senses, or you're in a different mainstream.
Right.
So I'm looking for a way to move.
Oh, I would go, Alan, go to Ananda Village in Grass Valley. If you have the independence of circumstance and finances, go to Ananda Village in Grass Valley. Check that one out. Just this week, they closed escrow on this phenomenal property outside of Portland, which is just this huge, overwhelmingly gigantic. They bought what used to be an academy, a school, for like a 400-student school, and it has 25,000 square feet of building on 53 acres. They just closed escrow on it. And that's just, like, gigantic. They don't know, that's a huge thing, so that's starting. In America, those are the two rural communities. The one in Portland started yesterday, and the one in Grass Valley, which is fully developed, but it is always welcoming.
But the thing that...
Or you can help us get one here. That's fine, too.
my concern is that my age, which I'm 60 right now, but...
a mere babe.
I said youth must go east, north, south, and west. And I was not even born yet when he said that, but I'm 60 now. But I have an adventurous spirit.
Oh, 60s. There's no... You're right on target. 60 is a very important astrological year to shift. And, you know, the youth can lift and carry, and the older people can do the stuff that doesn't take as many strong backs anymore. Ananda's a multi-generational everywhere. We have 20-year-olds, and we have 70- and 80-year-olds. It goes the whole spectrum. And not all of the over 60s came at 20. Many of them arrived at 60. Age is no obstacle. I mean... youth is required if there's a lot of heavy lifting. And in the first years of Ananda, in the late 60s and in the 70s, there was nothing. And, you know, we gardened with hoes and built with hammers, and it was better if you were younger and stronger. But now it's very comfortable. In fact, the little homes and everything are just beautiful. So there's a place for everyone. You're by no means, way, way by no means, you're not too old. Don't hesitate for a second. Rush into
That's
it. Goodbye, Holly. Don't hesitate for a second.
It's good to know that, Ananda's looking to the future, but not necessarily... Well, you have to transfer your ideology to a younger generation, but you're also growing in any age demographic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you have to appreciate also, soul is ageless. So the fact that this body is 60, you know, you could be either... much older in the spiritual path or much younger than people of who knows what age. We're not very age-oriented, because it's so such a transitory aspect of your nature. Age determines certain things, but very few that count. You know, the things that count don't have anything to do with age. Truthfully, it's just not an obstacle, not even a slight obstacle. Your adventurous spirit, yes, very good. I'm glad you asked the question. You should go to the Expanding Light at Ananda Village. Just, I don't know. You can go. It's open all the time. You can go tomorrow.
Speaking about within the next 2 weeks, because Tisha Devi put something on the website that said, come on up here. And it's like, wow, that sounds like they're talking to me.
I would get in your car tomorrow. I mean,
I'll
seriously.
My cats.
Get a cat sitter.
Yeah,
get a cat sitter and just go up. It'll thrill your heart to see it. If you've never seen it, it's just, you cannot imagine how fabulous it is, especially Ananda Village. It's just, it's been 40 years. It's beautiful physically, and it's astonishing in its vibrations. Because it's an alternative society based around the principles we're talking about. It's a whole other universe. And so you can't imagine it, because I've traveled a lot. There's nothing like it anywhere, really, literally. I'm not being, you know, sectarian. It just doesn't exist anywhere else. You know, what we have is very, very nice. Our community is lovely. Our temple is beautiful. What they have is of another order of magnitude, because it's 1,000 acres. So it's a whole universe. Fabulous. And the tulips are in bloom. You better hurry, though, because they're almost at the end.
I went to the work department the day I came home from spending a few days at the Expanding Light Center. And when I saw the pictures, I didn't even recognize that was me.
Isn't that something?
Glow to my face in the picture. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, who's that girl? I had spent a few days there. It was
yeah, people change in a matter of hours.
And I haven't been back since I need to go, but it was
No, you change in a matter of hours, because the whole texture of the atmosphere around you is different. You know, a sensitive person in this atmosphere is always a little bit walled off from the influences. I mean, you don't even know it. When I went there in 1971, after about 6 months, I suddenly had this enormous increase in energy. And I was pretty energetic when I started. But I realized that my whole life I'd been keeping a psychic shield up against my environment. And I grew up in a very nice home and had a very pleasant life, but I was just always holding this psychic shield. And after about 6 months living there, it's like it finally penetrated that I could just let it down. And when I let it down, it was just such a just complete shift. It was remarkable. And then you learn to live without ever putting it back up again. You learn to maintain your inner reality by other means, more by positive means than by negative means. But I'm not at all surprised. I had an argument with this girl. I worked in the kitchen when I first started there, and this, about 6 or 7 years later, I went with Swami to New York City, and we stayed in the apartment of these people, and my name had changed. Asha is the name Swami gave me, and when I introduced myself to them, I said, "Oh, I remember you. You helped in the kitchen when I worked there." They looked at me and they said, "No, that was someone else." I said, "No, it was me. You worked with me." "No," they said, "that wasn't you." And they said it about 3 times, and finally I just said, "Yeah, you're probably right." I mean, what could I say? But they were so convinced. They were absolutely convinced it could not possibly be the same person, and I just finally said, "Why not? Let me just take this compliment. And just leave it. So, go."
I'm glad I came tonight.
Uh-huh. I'm glad you did.
A lot of your Sunday services on the internet, I discovered Ananda Vatavarna a few months ago, early 2010.
Uh-huh.
So it drew me more and more, and I've watched a lot. I've probably watched more of your talks than anybody else.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of appropriate that you're the first person that I've approached. Because I'm normally kind of I'm not much of a joiner, but there's something about it that's very, and I feel I'm attuning to it very much.
You know, it's funny about Ananda. just about everyone who is part of Ananda says, I'm not much of a joiner. I'm not much of an organization person. I'm more of a lone wolf. I like to do things by myself. It is, you know, a community. I mean, there's a physical community. But a community is really just relationships among people. In fact, we're working on our Ananda Palo Alto concept of membership, and we're calling it just the community for self-realization. Because it's not a church, it's not a temple, it's not a dogma, it's not a religion. It's people of like mind being friends and finding that if we hang out together, it's really better than if we try to do it alone, because it's really hard to do it alone. And that's about the beginning and the end of it. 40 years ago when we started, we didn't have anything. So there was no possibility of thinking that we were anything. We were just bare land and a bunch of people struggling to, you know, get enough money for peanut butter. But now we actually look like something, which is really unfortunate. Because then people think we're something, but we're not. We're just a bunch of individual people who find it easier to do with our lives what we're trying to do with it if we help each other. And everything else is not that. Swami Kriyananda was asked once, what is the job of the spiritual director of Ananda? His answer, to protect the well-being of the individuals from the institution. That's his job as the founder of the organization, is to protect the individuals from the organization. Because, you know, organizations kind of get... But that sums it up. You know, and people are people and things happen, but that's what it's about. So that makes you one of us. The fact that you don't want to be one of anybody, it fits you right into the profile.